Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza and Matt Polacek, only on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome to another edition of Answers for the Family.
Coming to you live from Sober College in Woodland Hills, California, I'm Alan Cardoza, and with me is my co-host, Dr. Matt Polacek.
And for those of you, who have been listening, sending in questions and comments, thank you so much.
And please continue to help spread the word that every Monday from 11 a.m. to 12 noon Pacific time, this show will bring you special guests that can inspire, educate, and in some cases, entertain,
while bringing answers and options to making your lives happier, healthier, and more successful.
This show will address issues such as locating a runaway teen, family crisis intervention, building self-esteem, dealing with addictions, and so much more.
We'll introduce you to talented authors, caring people, and new innovations in the world of health, security, and fun for you and your family.
Now, with our experience working with families in crisis, we've been fortunate to work with many people who are providing great work as far as helping people and working to make this world a better place.
You know, Alan, a young adult's path to sustainable long-term recovery and healthy living really requires an approach that's comprehensive, specific to age, and creates a true emotional attachment to living a life of sobriety.
Well, Matt, I think we're in the right place to discuss this. Our guest today is the Associate Executive Director of Sober College, Oriana Murphy.
Oriana has over 12 years of addiction and mental health experience.
And she earned her social work, her master's in social work from the University of Southern California, and completed a master's of arts in psychology with a specialization in addiction.
Oriana has experience working in all aspects of the field, from inpatient to outpatient settings, as well as being very well integrated in our Southern California recovery community.
Oriana, welcome to Answers for the Family.
Thank you.
Tell us a little bit about your role here at Sober College and a little bit about Sober College.
Okay, well, thanks for having me. I am the Associate Executive Director of Sober College, which basically means that I oversee operations. So I oversee our counseling department, our academic department, and our operations, our, like the house needs, as well as our clinical department.
Okay, well, you know, we've already had two people that read our press release that contacted us, mm-hmm. and they had the same question. They said, tell us a little bit about the five core competency model that you have here at Sober College.
Sure. So we are based on five core competencies. We believe that an individual needs these five competencies essentially in their life to build a life of success. So they are emotional well-being, productivity, fitness, life skills, and sobriety. Of course.
So like a well-integrated approach. And, mm-hmm. you know, we're watching the news and we're hearing about these opioid epidemics, mm-hmm. and we're hearing marijuana legalization. There's so much change. Mm-hmm. Have you noticed, you know, changes similar to that of some of the young people coming through here?
Absolutely. We are seeing an increase of opiate addicts or opiate users. We are definitely seeing an increase in marijuana addiction, as well as, you know, it's so interesting. I was just talking about this with someone the other day that, you know, a long time ago, it used to be someone would test positive for marijuana for 30 days, and we're seeing people testing positive for 4 to 6 months, which says a lot about the marijuana that young adults are smoking these days or eating, I guess. And so we're seeing a big shift in what that looks like in terms of the addictive behaviors related to that. It's pretty fascinating.
To me, it seems like there's this misconception of with marijuana where people aren't going to, you know, need treatment for it. Mm-hmm. But at our, you know, at Betty Ford, we have, you know, 30 or 40% of our young adults are being treated specifically for mm-hmm. marijuana use disorder. Mm-hmm. You're seeing the same kind of trends.
Absolutely.
Here.
Wow.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, there are a lot of people that say, well, it's no different than alcohol or it's no worse than alcohol. Well, guess what? We have a lot of treatment facilities for alcohol as well.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I always think about marijuana use as sort of like the slow death. You know, a lot of people, I've always heard like, well, it's not as bad as heroin, whatever that means. Mm-hmm. So heroin may take aspects of your life away really quickly. Mm-hmm. I think with marijuana use, it sort of slowly pulls away all those things that you care about. but slowly or quickly it happens. So that's why I always think about the slow death. It's scary what we're seeing, you know, the marijuana induced psychosis. We're seeing that a lot more. And like I said, the addictive behaviors that we didn't see before, I think we're seeing very frequently.
And what's your thought on the medical application of it? I mean, there's lots of information out there that shows mm-hmm. that from a medical standpoint, that it is doing some good, mm-hmm. but at the same time, we also know that there are people abusing that privilege. What's your thoughts?
Well, I'm not a doctor, so okay. I hesitate to answer the question. I do believe that there are medical uses for the substance or the drug, but I think that there's also this over-prescribing thing that's happening, and it's really easy to get a prescription for marijuana these days. You know, you can walk in and the joke's always, you know, the doctor or whoever is prescribing saying, your ankle hurts, right? Your ankle hurts, right? And you have a lot of anxiety, right? Right? Okay, great. You know, and so my thing is it for medical? Is it for recreational? How do you know the difference sometimes?
That's scary. Mm-hmm. Well, and you probably run into the same thing.
Yeah, you know, I mean, the studies are, it's like 5 to 10 times more potent. Mm-hmm. And there's no regulations on the potency mm-hmm. of this. Mm-hmm. And so this isn't our grandma's, you know, or marijuana from 20, right. 30 years ago. And, you know, we're both, mm-hmm. Both places are seeing the effects.
Mm-hmm. Well, and also I think about the part that concerns me the most is sort of the driving under the influence. So we have a breathalyzer for alcohol. Someone's driving erratic. They're going to get breathalyzed typically if they're pulled over for that. But with marijuana, we don't have a saliva test yet or a breathalyzer yet. Whoever creates that will have the billion-dollar idea. But, you know, where there's just not so many regulations and we can't protect ourselves as much. So.
Mm-hmm. You know, to change it up a little bit, mm-hmm. I went to your website mm-hmm. and one of the common threads that I saw was fun. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of people doing things that are fun. Mm-hmm. Share with us how you've incorporated fun into the curriculum in such a way that it's working for you.
Well, I think to start, one of the things that I often hear when young adults are getting sober or they're faced with the idea of getting sober is, how am I ever going to have fun again? That's sort of the, you know, oh my God, how can I have a life without drugs and alcohol? How am I supposed to go to a party? I'm in college. How am I supposed to go to a party and not drink? So what we do is we believe it's so important to be able to teach people to laugh again. And those real belly laughs that we see and experience from our clients. So we'll do things like our experiential therapies are, there's a lot of fun related to those. So trapeze, surf therapy, you know, we used to do this wind tunnel, which is pretty cool. It's like mm-hmm. a skydiving simulation. Mm-hmm. We do skydiving with our clients. We have barbecues. We fellowship a lot. You know, we've done soberoki, which is karaoke, but no alcohol, obviously, and other things like that. And also providing some downtime along with the busy schedule so that people can connect. I think community is such an important piece for us, and providing that that brotherhood or that sisterhood where there's that area to build those relationships.
See, to me, this is the biggest issue that young people in recovery face is there's no age appropriate mm-hmm. activities. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. so you guys have created a curriculum base so they could be normal functioning people with people around them and not have to worry about influence and mm-hmm. you know, the outside mm-hmm. Substances.
Yeah, absolutely. We look to the 12-step community a lot. For these ideas, I mean, you hear in 12-step communities, these young people organizations where they have dances and they have bowling and, I mean, you know, football and all these sort of events that they create. So it teaches people that are in the community, hey, you can have fun. You can do these things without drinking and using. And that's so powerful to be able to have that experience.
Absolutely. And I think they need to get it on all campuses.
Yes.
In other words, not just a campus that's focused on being sober,
absolutely.
But get it on all campuses mm-hmm. because I don't know when it became the fact that you couldn't have fun right. in college without drugs mm-hmm. or alcohol.
And I've struggled, you know, I've had patients who are going back to school mm-hmm. and trying to find sober dorms or something along those lines. And it's harder to find than you would think.
Absolutely.
And so having a design program obviously is
right.
beneficial.
Well, I think that there's a lot of universities that have the collegiate recovery programs, mm-hmm. which are really great. But for everyone, because I think we hear all the time, well, everyone in college is drinking and smoking pot or whatever. And not everyone is drinking and smoking pot. you see that the most, but not everyone is doing it. But what the other communities that are there, they're not out there. So people aren't attracted to that because they're not seeing it. You know, we're sort of teaching our young adults that you can have that stuff so they can, I believe they can touch it and bring it out to the community because, you know, the ripple effect that can have. So
yeah. What are some of the mental health issues that seem to be working in conjunction with somebody's addiction issues?
We're seeing a lot of anxiety, depression, some of the, you know, like I said, the marijuana-induced psychosis, so psychotic features related to substance use. Is it the substance? Is it not? It's most of the things that we're seeing.
Mm-hmm. And you're seeing an increase in the synthetic marijuanas, too?
Absolutely.
And some of that dangerous, those more dangerous kind of...
Yeah, the wax.
The wax.
And all those names of things that I have to investigate all the time because I'm like, what are you talking about? Yeah, it's embarrassing, actually. I hear a new one every week, I feel like, so.
Have you noticed younger people not as prepared, probably, for college as we used to be, maybe? And so the pressure is leading to more drug use, maybe?
Absolutely. I think 18 is sort of this arbitrary age. It's like, oh, you're an adult at 18, you're ready for college. And I would argue that most individuals are not ready for college at 18, which I think is what's so scary. I mean, if the brain isn't, you know, fully developing until the age of 26, we're asking young adults to make these huge life decisions at the age of 18 and, you know, go across the country and go into this school and make the right decisions, you know, and drink with moderation. And, you know, when they're like, I want friends and I want to be a part of this. And, you know, oftentimes you're going to see that drinking as the socializing. It's scary.
We were discussing before the show that when I went away to college, I went with 5 or 6 buddies, and within the first 6 months, 3 or 4 of them were back at home.
Mm-hmm.
Just from that idea of not being ready and not, you know, emotionally being able to handle the stress.
Absolutely. I had a conversation with my own parents recently, and they said, you know, in hindsight, we were not ready. You were not ready to go across the country to college and have to be an adult, really, without sort of the ability to do so.
Now, what are some of the things that we can do differently at an earlier age so that we know that they are? I mean, is there a level of testing? Are there things that we can do to be able to say, you know what, maybe you're just not quite ready to go far away? Mm-hmm. You know, stay home, start at a community college for a couple of years while you're still living at home. Mm-hmm. You know, what are some of the other things that people can do?
You know, I think communication is necessary. I think about families that are able to talk about sort of concerns. There's a space where the teenage or young adult child can go to their parents and say, hey, like, you know, I had this experience at school, or I had this experience at a party and I'm confused and I don't know what this is. And you know, or I'm having this feeling and I feel like I'm the only person in the world that has this feeling. Can we talk about this? I'm sure so many teenagers would hear this and roll their eyes, but I think that that piece is so important. I think parents are scared to have those conversations because they don't want to allow or permit the use of substances. Mm-hmm. But providing that space is so comfortable, and then being able within that to really assess what makes sense. I mean, I am big proponent of education, and you know, and I think that finding the right school for you is really dependent on the individual, but making sure that there's the support in place beforehand, whether they're going to community college, whether they're going to, you know, across the country, whatever that decision is as a family, that there's a support in the background that they can always return to is monumental, you know. So I think that's really that piece, is what are we saying to our kids, what are we talking about?
Right.
You know, one of the cool things about this show is people know what we're going to talk about before we go on. And so we've got a lot of parents out there probably listening and watching. Mm-hmm. What advice would you give for parents whose kids are struggling with substance abuse issues?
Number one, pay attention. Listen to your gut. I think that's super important. I think most parents would argue that they knew it. You know, you always ask them, I knew something was going on. Something is probably going on. If you notice a change in behavior, a drastic change in behavior especially, there's definitely something going on. It may not be drug use, but there's something happening and a conversation needs to start. And then again, providing the resources if needed, you know.
And you know, along those lines, we had a young man that was in a program mm-hmm. that was answering some questions that came into a conference room. Yeah. We went directly to that program. And I was told afterwards that the answers that he gave was the most powerful answers that they had ever heard. And one of the ones was a grandmother had called and asked a very similar question than what Matt just asked. Mm-hmm. And she said, you know, I don't know how to tell. You know, every time I talk to him, they say, well, you know, my friend left that there. It's not me, and so on. And this young man said, I'd like to share something with all of the parents and grandparents out there. And he looked and he went, we lie. Mm-hmm. And then when you catch us, we lie again. Mm-hmm. And it was so powerful. We had so many people that called in afterwards, parents that went, I can't believe that a 15-year-old just told us the truth.
Yeah. You know? Yeah.
Absolutely. But you talk about that gut feeling,
yeah.
You know, as a parent, yeah. you know, mm-hmm. you've got that gut feeling.
Yeah. And I think, you know, I laugh because I can't, as a new parent, so I all these things that, you know, I used to hear, I'm like, I know now why my parents said that. But, you know, it was important for my parents to know my friend's parents. Mm-hmm. And I think that's very important. Who are your kids hanging out with? Who are these individuals? Get to know them. I think get to know their friends. Because if you're not able to see it, sometimes we have these rose-colored glasses with the people we love. If you're not able to see the changes in your child, you might see it in their friends. Why aren't they hanging out with that group of friends anymore? You know, or why does, you know, Sally seem different than she did, you know, a couple months ago? What's going on? But yeah, that's the thing. I mean, you know, that's part of their job. Adolescents' job is to lie, right? And to protect whatever it is that they're protecting. And you know, that's the hard line, because it's like, do you attack the lie and go after and after and after it? It's like, I don't know if that's always the case or that's what needs to happen, but trust your gut and do something about it, even if it's just opening the conversation.
Yeah. And I think to add to that, because I know I was speaking with a mother one time and she said, well, I don't want to call him on that because then he won't like me. And I said, you know what? I said, your son does not need a 45-year-old best friend.
Right.
You're a parent. Your job
Absolutely.
Is to parent, not to be their best friend.
Absolutely.
If you believe it, if your gut tells you that's happening, call them on it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, we have to untangle a lot of that. Oftentimes, parents would rather be the friend than the parent. Mm-hmm. I understand that having to be the parent at times is probably the most challenging thing mm-hmm. that one needs to do. But when we see someone come into our program and we see a lot of permissive behavior from the parents, mm-hmm. essentially, most of our job is unpacking that and trying to reparent the client, essentially, showing them what sort of what lines are, what boundaries are. You know, we'll just take apart the mixed messages. Mm-hmm. With the parents, it's, hey, like, you're an adult. Mm-hmm. You don't have to have that conversation with, you don't have to talk about your money with your kid, you know?
Sure. So parents do play a role in the program here.
Absolutely.
Oh, okay.
Huge part in the program. We involve parents from the gate, even though our population is over 18. Mm-hmm. Parents are involved every step of the way. Our counselors call the parents weekly, updating them on progress, educating them on boundaries, pushing Al-Anon all the time. We also have a family weekend that we have every 6 weeks, and that's where a group of families come in and do some really awesome clinical work. The parent work is just as, I think, active as the work with the clients.
You know, we spoke earlier about the young person who may not be ready to go mm-hmm. away. Mm-hmm. Let's flip the script a little bit and mm-hmm. say, what about the one that needs a parentectomy? They mm-hmm. need to go away and they need a parentectomy. The parents need to pull back. Mm-hmm. How do you deal with that parent that is constantly interfering mm-hmm. or sabotaging the good work that's being done?
I have said to many parents, I need you to let me do my job. Usually, before that conversation is had, we actually let the parent sort of engage and then make that decision. But we've had to, you know, pull parents off of phone calls. We've had to just set really firm boundaries. And, you know, I've said to parents, you're going to allow your son to die. And that's the reality. And that is so hard. You know, when we have clients come in that don't want to be in treatment, and it's imperative that they're in treatment, sort of what you're talking about. And they want to leave. And, you know, we're not a lockdown program. So this happens, you know, it happens some, not often, but every once in a while you see it. A lot of the work we're doing with the parents is, hey, you need to set a boundary here. What does it look like if they leave? When parents have a sort of allowed, hey, we're going to take you back in, knowing that, you know, 30 days ago they were shooting heroin, I've said to parents, like, you're going to kill your son. And that's just the reality. And I'm not going to sugarcoat it. Mm-hmm. Our job is to be honest and transparent. It's not to sort of protect, like, the sickness and the dysfunction in the family.
I think that's a great point.
We're talking about the negative side mm-hmm. of this nasty, nasty
right.
world we're in.
Right.
But there's great stories that have come out of
Absolutely.
Sober College. And later today, we're going to get to hear one.
Yeah.
But will you share maybe one or two stories that while you have been here has mm-hmm. been, you know, something really exciting?
Sure. A lot. I mean, we've done such incredible work, and there's so many great clients that have come through our program. One person I think of in particular was an individual that I was actually the counselor for. So this is some years back. He had come to our program, a serious, serious self-identified alcoholic. He had, you know, had some sobriety, relapsed, came back into treatment, came with us, and struggled. I mean, he was totally bought into the 12 steps, so that was not the issue. But he had some behavioral stuff, some conflicts with others. Every day wanted to leave the program. I mean, would come in my office every day. I'm leaving every day. You know, it was like this whole thing. And what ended up happening, he was dead set on leaving at 90 days, and there was no way around it. And his mom was going to let him leave at 90 days, too. She wasn't going to hold any line. He and his mom participated in a family weekend, and something magic happened there, which it always does. And he told his mom at the end of the weekend that he wanted to stay however long it took. And I like have chills thinking about it. He ended up enrolling in an EMT program. And he struggled. It was hard. We had, you know, he had to do tutoring, the whole deal. And he ended up staying through sober living. He ended up going back home, got a job as an EMT. And now he's, you know, I think he's like fire ranger. And he's doing all these, he's pursuing all these incredible goals. And he has about 3 years now. And totally... total 180 from who this guy was. And
he's losing his life, and now he's saving him with
yeah,
Narcan, using
yeah.
Narcan and other things.
Absolutely.
To save people's lives.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's amazing. And that's just one. I see that story time and time again. And it's incredible. I mean, that's what keeps me doing this, you know.
Well, as far as what keeps you doing it, what is the best part of it? And what's the worst part?
For me, I think the best part is seeing families come back together. I really love family work, and seeing a family be rebuilt is on all sides. You know, I love that. I think seeing clients come in and get that sort of passion for recovery in their eyes, because that was my journey, and seeing that is amazing. Or if someone doesn't quite get it the first time, And coming back and jumping in and having this new experience is, I mean, that's why we're doing this. You know, I think the worst part, people die. It happens, you know. I think people not getting it or not really ready to be done. I think a lot of what we do in treatment is we raise the bottom. And that doesn't work for everyone. And having to see people leave and knowing that they need to go figure it out. You know, sort of the outcome of what that is. I mean, this is, you said it, this is terrifying and deadly, and we're in it, you know, it's like a battlefield every day.
You know, when you say that, I think that we know your program works.
Mm-hmm.
We know like 12 step works,
mm-hmm.
yet people still fight it.
Yeah.
And I see every day, you know, great people who run a great 12-step program and they stay in recovery, yet that you see people who just want to keep fighting against, you know, going against the curve.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, you know, it's like if we're looking at addiction as this brain-based disease, right, mm-hmm. and then we look at something like diabetes, I mean, no one tends to, well, not at, some people will fight it,
right.
But they're like, what do I need to do? What's the treatment? How do I, you know, here I want this healthy life. With addiction, it's like, oh, I this is awful, but I'm not going to do that. That's that one thing I'm not going to do. I'm not going to do that. And it blows my mind because it's the insanity around it. It's the insanity that parents don't understand, watching their son do the same thing over and over, expecting different results.
And we have the recipe.
Yeah. And it's like, here it is. It's actually pretty easy. It's pretty simple. But I think the idea of having to just, it's really turn it over, if I use a 12-step phrase, is so challenging, especially for young adults who are really trying to master their independence and, you know, be like, this is who I am to the world, and thinking they're invincible. I mean, this population is so difficult, but so incredible. And it's like, I'm not willing to do it your way. It's like almost against the establishment. You know, we see that stuff a lot. But when we kind of just want to smack them around and say like, but it's so easy. It's right here. Just do it. You know, I don't really smack them, but I'd like to sometimes.
Well, Matt, you brought up some questions in regard to success stories. Fortunately, we have one here. So we're going to take a break. We will be right back. Stay with us. You're listening to Answers for the Family.
Founded over 25 years ago to meet the needs of families in crisis, West Shield specializes in resolving adolescent issues that negatively impact the family. From preteen to young adult, we are experienced and qualified to help. We offer solutions which include referrals to a network of top professionals internationally that we work very closely with in the fields of educational consulting, psychology, and psychiatry. Our in-home crisis intervention care program helps to stabilize families and bring effective resolution. We are supported by our licensed investigation company that enables us to offer legal and expert services for locating runaway teens and more. Our therapeutic transportation services help to ensure that adolescents in crisis are safely provided transportation to specialized schools and programs with unmatched experience and success. Simply put, West Shield Adolescent Services is the best solution when your family is facing personal crisis. Call 1-800-899-8585 and let us help you.
All right, we're back. You're listening to Answers for the Family. We're here live from Sober College, and we have a new guest. This is Kyle.
Hey, how's it going, Alan? How's it going, Matt?
Welcome.
Great to be here.
And it's great to have you here. And as I spoke a little bit earlier in regards to another young man who was actually spoke while in a program, I know you're a recent graduate here, so share with us a little bit, starting with maybe what you were going through before you ended up needing to go to a program.
Okay, so this was about 2 years ago, I guess, 3 years ago. I was in and out of treatments, struggling with opiate addiction. It was a really rough time. I was going through 30-day treatments, coming out, relapsing immediately. That was the cycle, and then I decided I needed long-term treatment.
Okay, when you say you decided, did your parents help you with this decision?
To an extent, yeah, they did. I mean, they were like, you know, you need long-term treatment, and I agreed. You know, they obviously were supporting me, so they obviously made some of the decisions. But yeah, it was a mutual thing. I knew I needed the help.
That's great. Mm-hmm. Share with us a little bit about what was different. You said you went through some other programs and it didn't work. What were some of the biggest differences that allowed this to take that maybe others didn't?
I mean, the other programs were 30 days, you know, just straight groups after group after group, no fun. I didn't learn how to live outside of treatment, you know. I came here and, you know, they teach you, as a young adult, I didn't know how to live yet. You know, people say 18, like Orion was saying earlier, 18 and you should know how to live life, and I didn't know how to do that. And here they teach you the skills that you need to live life.
It's fascinating. It's like what you were saying about programs. You know, you go for an hour or two and then you leave. But here, you're part of a community and you're part of a young people in recovery's group, to where, like you said, day-to-day activities, laundry, you know, cooking, all these things, versus going to a program for a couple hours and having to go on your own.
Exactly.
It's a different world.
Yeah, it really is. It's like, you know, like you said, having similarities with these young adults that you can talk about is key, you know. And it's like the 12th step, you know, you have similarities, you talk to people and you recover. Here it's the same thing. I think you have a lot of young people around you, you talk about your similarities with your struggles, and you learn how to relate to that community.
when you said earlier you had a couple programs that didn't work, yeah. Were you a little bit disillusioned going to 12-step meetings with more adults than young people in recovery or anything like that?
Oh, definitely. I mean, in Texas, where I'm from, it's a lot of old timers in these AA meetings. So that kind of turned me away. I was like, I don't want to live this life. And I don't think I was ready yet either when I was back then. I still wanted to have fun. I was like, how am I going to have fun? All my friends are partying, you know? So I wasn't ready at that time, but that also turned me away from the program, I think.
Now, you bring up a good point about your friends are partying. Mm-hmm. How much of an advantage was it to go to a program that's far away from that group of friends? Did that help you to spend a certain amount of time away from them?
Yeah, that was huge. I think, obviously, a geographic move doesn't automatically mean recovery.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But getting away from those people for a long-term period and not communicating with them. Because I know a lot of people that come in and still communicate with those friends, mm-hmm. and that's not good because they're going to try to convince you, come back home, we're having parties, you know, we're having fun. Mm-hmm. For me, I just kind of put them away and didn't talk to them for at least a year, you know. And getting away from that environment was huge for me.
And how was the cultural change to now being essentially in a sober culture?
Yeah, that was a big difference, obviously, but when I got here, I learned how to have fun. Like I said, all these people, you know, we were on a ski trip, we were doing trapeze, we're doing all these crazy things I've never done before. And I was like, wow, you can really have fun while being sober. And enjoying that with other people that were doing the same thing was huge.
I was going to say, you also joined, I think the film department
essentially
is such a big piece.
Definitely.
Like I always talk about, we have an improv group essentially on Mondays and in our part of our creative arts block, and Kyle's a big part of that. And to me, that's like the most terrifying thing ever, you know, putting yourself out there and having, you know, God forbid someone laughs at you, even though they don't probably, or they laugh with you, but like things like that is, and I know Kyle's been a big part of that, which is super cool.
Yeah.
People look up to him for that.
I mean, this improv group that I did taught me how to get out of myself and not worry about so much what people thought about me. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a huge thing. You know, people laugh at me and I don't get embarrassed. I can talk in front of people. Like 2 years ago, I could not sit here and have a conversation with you guys. And it's huge.
That's what I was thinking about. You know, the opioid crisis or epidemic we're living in. I hear people all the time, they're not, you know, I'm never going to be happy again. And we're sitting across the couch from someone with a big smile on his face. Mm-hmm. It's love and life.
Yeah, it's crazy. Like 2 years ago, like I said, I was sick and tired of being sick and tired. I didn't think there was a way for me to be happy. I was stuck doing the same thing every day. And like, if you told me I'd be here 2 years ago, I wouldn't believe you.
For people out there that are watching, what would you tell someone that's right now, you know, thinking about getting sober from opioids, heroin, prescription?
Yeah, I would tell them that there is hope, because I didn't have hope, but you have to... You have a chance. You just have to find the right place. Like, you can have fun. This is for young adults, because that's for me. But, I learned how to have fun. You come to places, you meet people, and there is hope, you know. I didn't think there was, and look at me now. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Now, that's a great message for young people that might be struggling. What would your message be to the parents of a 15 to 17-year-old that's not coming home, or that is coming home but high, and they're struggling with how to deal with it, you know, as parents do, because there's that thing, you love them, you want everything you possibly can to help them, mm-hmm. but at the same time, you know, there's a divide.
Yeah.
Okay, what do you tell those parents? What would you share?
That's tough, because my parents enabled me for many years. You know, they knew what was going on. Like Oriana said, they had that gut feeling. They knew something was going on, but they were scared to do something. I'm not really sure, because I wasn't in their head. But, you know, my dad was always at work, kind of just out of sight, out of mind with me. And my mom, she kind of, you know, here's money, go do what you're doing. And, you know, she didn't really follow her gut. But I would tell them that at some point you got to follow your gut and put your foot down, because that's what helped me. My dad told me, look, you're not coming home this time. You have to stay. We're not going to help you if you come home. And so that was the thing that really made me stay.
That reminds me of the boundaries.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You were talking about earlier, setting boundaries mm-hmm. with parents.
Absolutely. I think, we were talking about, you know, they were scared and they didn't know what to do. And I mean, I hear the ultimate fear from a parent, I hear this a lot, is, oh my God, if I set a boundary and they run, what do I do then? Right. Am I killing them just as quickly that way? If they're going to live on the streets, my son can't live on the street. My daughter can't live on the street. And yes, some people will choose that and they'll do it. I often see people end up calling saying like, okay, what do you want? Yeah. You know? And that I think is the hardest thing is like, how do you face that? Knowing that, okay, if I don't do what my kid's telling me to do, then they're going to never talk to me again, or they're going to leave. Mm-hmm. They're going to go be homeless. They're going to, you know, it's so hard to tell a parent they may have to do that.
I couldn't imagine doing that as a parent. I mean, it's got to be so difficult.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And as a detective, mm-hmm. as somebody who locates those that do run away, mm-hmm. the saddest thing I ever did was I had to identify a body for a family because the young person had run away from another state, mm-hmm. and I was the one that was there.
Mm-hmm.
It was it's the worst phone call that I ever had to make was to call them and say, yes, mm-hmm. that is your child. So again, as you say, to tell the parents, you know, you may think that you're helping by saying, you know, oh, it's okay, we won't ground you or we won't do this. But as you said, going out, living on the streets, and especially at this day and age, mm-hmm. it is far more dangerous mm-hmm. to do that, mm-hmm. you know, for them to try to make it out there mm-hmm. than it is for you to stand up to them as a parent and mm-hmm. say, you have to fix this problem. Mm-hmm. You know, there are programs that can help you.
Mm-hmm. And I also think doing that early on and setting that tone early on, not of like a punishing or vindictive family life, mm-hmm. but you know, if you're grounding your child, like don't not ground them, you know, yeah. actually ground them. You know, if you're deciding
through.
That grounding is what you do in your family, follow mm-hmm. through with it. If you say, I'm taking your cell phone, take their cell phone, you know, because I think we don't want the mixed message anymore. I often hear clients say like, oh, sometimes my parents say this, sometimes they say this, or, oh, they didn't really mean it when they said this. Mean it, mean what you say. And I think ultimately it's about safety and keeping people alive. And I would have hated to hear this when I was a teenager, but I knew that my parents meant their boundary. It was like, you were grounded, I was grounded. That was it, you know? And so having those conversations early on and setting that tone early on prevents that big thing of, no, I'm not bailing you out of jail. Okay, but you've bailed me out every single time. Why are you changing all of a sudden? So setting that tone from the beginning.
We've got an email that came in. And again, we want to thank everybody for sending in the emails to take the time. We know many people work in the middle of the day, mm-hmm. so to take the time beforehand and to send these in, we very much appreciate it. I think this addresses a little bit about what we're talking about. This one reads, we are parents of a high school senior who graduates in a little over a month. Every day we are becoming more uncomfortable with her attending college out of state because we have caught her lying repeatedly about drinking and feel that she may be on the path to an alcohol addiction. Mm-hmm. We are in full on discussions on how to preempt or deal with the issue. Can you provide some suggestions? And this is from Charles in New Mexico. And thank you, Charles.
Do you have any thoughts?
For me, when I was 18, ready to go to out-of-state college in Arizona, my parents told me later on, they're like, we knew you weren't ready for college. Mm-hmm. We knew you weren't ready for college. You shouldn't have gone off. And I agree now, looking back. I should have stayed local, maybe community college, been close to home. But going out of state, I just ran wild. And I think if you have that doubt of sending your kid out of state to college, you should follow your gut again and, you know, make them stay local, I think.
I also think that, you know, there's ways of... you know, because it's like follow my gut versus living in fear. I don't, you know, it's really confusing sometimes. But I do think there might be ways of, hey, these are the agreements for the summer. Mm-hmm. And I need you to abide by these things. And yeah. if you can't abide by them, you are losing the opportunity to go away this year. And we can look at it next year. Maybe we go to community college. So whether that's, you know, drug testing, whether that's breathalyzer, whatever it is, you know, maybe it's, you know, they can't have the car during certain hours. I mean, whatever the family decides, but sort of setting up an agreement of we're going to do this together. So if you can, you know, what things should we come up with together as a family and that we can agree on and see how that works and then making a decision from there too.
Like what's a realistic expectation for an 18-year-old going off to college?
Yeah.
And what should that look like?
Yeah.
Well, we've heard the story of how you got here. Mm-hmm. Well, what's next?
What's next? Well, right now I'm going to college. I work here at Sober College in the film department. Learning a lot, finding a passion of film, which is really awesome because when I came in, I had never experienced film. I didn't know really anything about it. I got into an internship and I found a passion, which is incredible because I didn't have any passions before I came here. So yeah, going to college, hopefully transferring to a four-year school soon, working, have great relationships. Me and my family talk regularly. My dad tells me he's proud of me. I never thought that would happen. So yeah, life's great right now. Have a great group of friends, living on my own. It's incredible.
Well, shall we go to another question?
Sure. This one's coming in from William in San Diego. And William's asking, a professor at a small private college, it is alarming to see an increasing number of my students demonstrate the physical appearance, behavior, and academic performance that would suggest an addiction of some sort. I have to wonder what approach you're using that brings these people to the realization that they actually have a problem and to get them to seek help. This is from William in San Diego.
You know, it's interesting. I'm always sort of torn with the how do I identify if I have an addiction or not question, because I think it's really important that people identify it for themselves. However, I think that part of our job as mental health and addiction professionals essentially is to, you know, get to know the client and investigate with them. So pros and cons, you know, of their use. How is it affecting your life? Okay, you don't want to be sober for the rest of your life, but what are your goals? We talk, you know, talk about motivational interviewing, mm-hmm. which is a, you know, a method of counseling, and that's kind of what I'm talking about, which is, you know, what are your goals and how is alcohol and drug use interfering with those goals? But getting the client to see it for themselves, because I could tell you all day long that I think you have a drug problem, but you're not going to believe it until you internalize it yourself. So I think that's really the piece, is just asking questions, investigating, and, you know, getting someone to a place, because it's hard to wrap your head around being sober for the rest of your life, right? So a lot of times what we do is, hey, like while you're here with us, you need to be sober. While you're here, you got to work the 12 steps. You may decide when you leave here that you're not going to do that, mm-hmm. especially, you know, if your parents are supporting you. Maybe you might want to do these things now, but once you're supporting yourself and making your own financial decisions, you might want to make some other choices with your life. But right now, like, why don't we try this out?
For you, did it take a long time to get to that point of evaluating the problems versus the, you know, whether I had a problem or not? I mean, where did that, how did that come in?
Yeah, I mean, it's just like Oriana said, it just took time, you know, to realize that I had a problem. Because for years, I was like, no, I don't have a problem. This is what all kids do. All kids are, you know, using drugs and drinking. I just didn't realize to the extent I was doing it. So it definitely took some time to realize that. But I mean, once you have that, you have a moment of clarity where you finally realize, like, wow, I do have a problem. And that's what happened for me.
Now, Kyle, how much of that realization was that you reached a point to where you realized that you were having more fun being sober mm-hmm. than you thought you were having when you were doing drugs?
Yeah. I mean, the first 3 months that I was here, I mean, I thought I was only going to be here for 90 days. I ended up here for 15 months. But the first 90 days, I think, is really where it kind of started. Like, I started meeting all these people. I started actually doing things, having fun doing things other than using drugs. So that started the realization. But I mean, every day, I think it got better and better. And within, once I got to sober living, I was like, I don't even need drugs to have fun. So
realistically, you know, because you were an opioid guy, and we had a brief conversation before about opioids. To start feeling good again, how many days did it really take where you started to feel? Because I know it's a long time, and I think people have to have realistic expectations.
Yeah.
You know, there's a mental part of it. There's a physical withdrawal at first. But for you, what would you say the turning point was so people know what they need to get to?
Yeah. I mean, I think, first of all, you just need to get active. I was in the gym. I was working out a lot. I was getting back to sleep normal. And I think it took about, like, you know, 30 days to get really over the physical feelings, but the mental took, you know, more than that. I can't put an exact date on it, obviously, but eventually it just started falling out of my mind. And, 12-step, like you said, physical, mental, therapy, having fun, all of those things together really, really changed me.
I think people underestimate the power of cravings, and they're sort of the overt cravings and the covert cravings. And we sometimes will see the ones over time that the actual cravings are gone, that voice that's like, you should use again one more time. And it starts to turn into this, you should leave. It'll be so much better out there. Mm-hmm. You don't want to use, but you should totally leave, mm-hmm. And so we try and help people, identify those as that could be a craving to use. That's our biggest battle sometimes, getting someone to admit
they're
that.
They're two steps away from the, they've already made like a mental relapse, basically.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Now, Oriana, you mentioned earlier about the fact that we all kind of grow up at a different age or at a different time. It takes a different amount of time. Mm-hmm. In the same sense, what is usually the range? Because it sounds like from what Kyle is saying, it's a little bit different for everybody in regards to when they come to that realization.
Mm-hmm.
Is this kind of why the 90 days is important, because it's somehow spread between that time?
Yeah, I mean, I actually believe that although we're minimum 90 days, I think it really takes, the change starts to happen between 90 days and 6 months, and then the bigger changes come after that. I mean, we see, and I would say this would be the same for you, that the first 90 days you see who you see, right? And there's still a fog there, and you're trying to get buy-in, you're trying to integrate, engage the client. And then they stick around and something shifts somewhere around like, God, I don't know, it's like 4 or 5 months when someone's actively participating, I think, in their own recovery and have like a best investment in their life. And they start to see those changes, and then they then go into sober living after 6 months, and that's when they have more freedom to do sort of their own thing, go after that passion. We're into passion development big time, and start to live a life that's somewhat normal, but with safety measures around it. So curfews, drug testing, that kind of stuff. But I think in the first 90 days, I mean, the changes don't happen until after that, Those 90 days are so important to get someone grounded, stabilized, get them engaged, get them invested. But you really need to stick it out, I think, to make some real changes.
All right. We've got just a couple of minutes left. Is there anything else that you would like to share? What are the things that you feel that the professionals, the parents, the young people that are watching and or listening should know about either your personal struggle or your belief in the things that really help?
One of the things I mentioned it just a second ago, passion development, to me, that's key. You hear a lot of people saying, people in long-term recovery talk about, I needed to build a life worth staying sober for. That is such a hard thing to imagine when you're newly sober. But that passion development piece is what gives you that. And so, which is why we have the fun and the activities and the internship programs and the creative arts, giving an experience to someone of all those different choices so that they can discover what they're interested in, and giving that experience early on versus waiting till they've been sober for 6 months or waiting till they're outside of treatment. I think that is such what really makes the difference. As well as, which kind of goes into it, but getting someone in a place where they're feeling like they're productive and they're working towards something in their life versus pausing it before, to go to treatment, stopping everything, keeping that engaged. I think that's the thing that works, and that's what I've seen from clients, from my friends, from my own experience in recovery. Getting involved in something that I love or started to love early on from the beginning is the thing that really kept me going, and it was like, God, I wouldn't want to risk this for anything.
Yeah, I would agree with mostly what she said. But for all the kids out there or young adults that are my age, the sober life, if you're struggling with drugs and alcohol, the sober life is the better life. I'm happy now. There is happiness. I didn't think I could ever be happy. Real true happiness. Like I come to work happy, I go to school happy, I go to sleep happy. And that all can be possible if you follow the steps of getting sober, following a passion, getting active, finding people that are similar to you, and having fun.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thank you so much. I mean, it does so much for everybody out there, especially sharing your own story. And Oriana, I mean, everything that you're doing here at Sober College is wonderful. appreciate it very much. Mm-hmm. Again, for everybody out there, please be sure that you put us on your calendar and tune in next week when we're joined by Ann Jones, author of What We're Afraid to Ask, 365 Days of Healing for Adult Survivors of Childhood Abuse.
And if you missed and you want to share our shows with your friends, please visit our archives of past interviews at answersforthefamily.com. You may also subscribe or resubmit your name to download your free copy of the Attitude of Gratitude Journal, your 21-day guide to achieving the quality of thankfulness through self-discovery.
And the next time you're on Facebook or Twitter, please remember to stop by our page and check out some of our posts. And if you like them, please like us and spread the word. Thank you for listening to Answers for the Family, and be good human beings.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza and Matt Polacek, only on LA Talk Radio.